This is URN Sport.
Yes, welcome back to the Premier League show from 3pm until 5pm. So far, Notts County have beaten Mansfield 1-0 and a crunch result in League 2. That puts them within 2 points of safety, which is crazy when you think back to the beginning of the season when I think they lost something like 7 in a row. It was awful. We are also going to be keeping up to date with more FA Cup games in terms of AFC Wimbledon versus Millwall, and it's at King's Meadow. Alex Duke will be in charge of that. On the panel, we also have Jeremy Dunn, Declan Boardman and James Aldred. I'm going to start it off, though, by previewing Man United versus Chelsea, which is coming up in the FA Cup on Monday. Now, with Man United's shocking performance, I think that's not controversial to say, against Paris Saint-Germain, and then Chelsea's terrible performance against against Manchester City, 6-0, who are you backing to win this game? Jez, I'm coming to you first.
Oh, okay. Difficult to pick because they're both teams that are in a bit of iffy form. I would probably go for Man United because generally their form has been more consistent. The PSG game, I think, was finally a wrap around the knuckles that they needed to be reminded that they aren't exactly an all-conquering side like they have been. United fans have been droning on recently that they have been. Quite funny when we've got, so I've just realised, four Liverpool fans and an Everton fan on the panel. So this is going to be completely impartial. I would back United, though. I think overall they are probably better. Declan and I have been talking about some of the things behind Chelsea, which I'm sure we'll probably come on to in a bit as well, talking about that. But I think overall the situation at United is probably more stable. But the long-term kind of knocks to Martial and Lingard could be more of a hindrance than they are. And I think it's safe, so I actually sort of was quite delighted last night in the pub when it was confirmed that it was going to be out for the Liverpool games. I know that those two always have a bit of form against us. I would say overall I'd favour United, though. And I think of all the United players, oddly, Alexis might be the one that could possibly turn up because he's been getting absolutely rinsed in the media this week. And if he's going to have a point to prove, he's going to show what he's worth. I think this could be the game where he might have the opportunity to.
Yeah, I mean, you touched on Alexis Sanchez there, and I think Freddie Ljungberg came out this week or some ex-Arsenal legend and said that Alexis Sanchez could go back to Arsenal. Deck, what do you think of that transfer?
It's so low of rubbish, that, isn't it? It's just a little tosh. I think with Alexis Sanchez, it has been very, very difficult, the fact that he's gone to Manchester United and not exactly had the form that he had at Arsenal. But I think what does need to be mentioned is the fact that when he has played in certain games, he can sometimes change the fortunes for Manchester United. It's just when he can do it. He obviously lost about a yard of pace, but he's still got technique, he's still got finesse. I think what Jez has talked about in the fact that he could do something against Chelsea, yeah, with the fact that Anthony Martial is out of the side, yes, he perfectly could do that. But I think what is the problem at Manchester United right now is there's so many maybe men of, they could perform today, we don't know if they are going to. And if you're an Arsenal fan and you're hearing from Freddie Ljungberg, of all people, that they could bring back Alexis Sanchez, what does he bring? If you are looking at improving the Arsenal side from what they were when they were under Arsene Wenger, and you've brought in Emery and you want to eliminate all these pansy footballers and you want to make sure that you have players with a bit more steel about them, bringing back somebody like Sanchez, who's obviously lost a yard of pace and lost a lot of form, is not the answer, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think that's pretty necessary. James, what are you going
to... Well, just building on Dec's point there, Arsenal under Emery trying to build this new style, move forwards in a positive direction, and it appeared like the days of Arsenal picking up kind of leftovers from the top, kind of from the clubs that are ahead of them in the league were long gone. You look at the transfer of Mkhitaryan last summer. Emery's come out and said that those days are behind Arsenal, but if they were to go and get Sanchez, granted he is on his day a very, very talented player, it would just kind of seem to be exactly the same as the Mkhitaryan transfer, really getting somebody in who's been unable to deliver at the top end of the table. And if Arsenal want to get to that level, then why are you looking to sign somebody who's failed to deliver at that end, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think the continuous problem with Arsenal is still the fact that they haven't signed a top-quality, world-class centre-back. And I think when Arsenal fans look at the rumour of Alexis Sanchez, they'll probably think, we don't need him, he's not a priority player. They will always score goals because they have Aubameyang and Lacazette and, well, I say Iwobi, I don't want to put him in the same bracket as those two players, but they are threatening up front. The fact is, what Arsenal needs to prioritise is getting a centre-back of kind of Kalidou Koulibaly's level and kind of echo what Liverpool have done with Van Dijk. Get a top quality centre back to kind of reinforce that defence and really improve them. And just a bit of, sorry, AFC Wimbledon Millwall news. In 5 minutes, Millwall have gone one goal ahead. And given Wimbledon's form, that's not very surprising. Murray Wallace, there are two Wallaces on the team, slightly confusing. Murray Wallace, the centre-back, has put Millwall in front, so 1-0 there.
A little bit of a shame there. We're hoping for a decent match. Hopefully Millwall don't now go and run away with it. But going back to the Man United versus Liverpool game, So are we all backing Man United to win this game? Is there no contention to that?
I'll play devil's advocate. I think United will throw everything at Liverpool on Saturday, at the weekend. So I feel like key players will be rested to ensure that United get 3 points against Liverpool, which is obviously terrifying as a Liverpool fan. But I feel like Pogba might be rested, Herrera might be rested, potentially Rashford, just one of those key players. If you take one of those three out, I feel Chelsea, who really need to sort of prove themselves, might be able to get something. I mean, I do think United will edge it, but I'll try and play the devil's advocate and say maybe Chelsea could get a draw and a replay.
Yeah, I'd expect Lukaku to start in this because Solskjaer started Lukaku in their last... I mean, we've only got, unfortunately, one... If we're saying looking at their cup form, we've only really got one cup game to look at it, which is the match against Arsenal. But he did start both Alexis and Lukaku in that game. So I'd expect them to start if they aren't going to play against Liverpool. But like Alex said, I think United have definitely got both eyes set on that what could very well be for both sides a season-defining fixture at Old Trafford, which is a real pain. I think Chelsea could... They have the potential to cause an upset. They've been ridiculed so much recently in the press that if any of those Chelsea players, and as has been made probably abundantly clear by my talks this morning, both on Whistleblowers and View from the Stands, I don't like the Chelsea players at all. If any of them have backbone, which I think is something which is lacking, and it's something which Declan and I have said multiple times when we were watching that City game, if any of them have it, they will show it in this United game. They're going to need to basically stand up and make it this camp. But United, I think probably for them, they're looking at, and I was speaking to my dad earlier in the week, who is a United fan. Yes, I know, Liverpool fan, he's son of a United fan. It's a bit weird, trust me. But he was saying that for United fans, they are viewing it as very much a case of if they can get the FA Cup, which I think one which they really want to win, actually, and get top four, then it's actually going to be a pretty damn good season, given how appalling it was at parts.
Yeah, Dec, if he does lose all... let's say he loses this Chelsea game, then he loses the Man United game, and he loses to PSG again. So they're out of, say, three... they're effectively out of all competitions, if we're saying they're out of the Premier League. Then does that put Ole's job on the line? I mean, put yourself into neutral shoes and say, if they're not going to win anything, is top four what is going to define whether Ole gets the job or not?
Look, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was given that job to reunite the fans and the players. I think with what has happened in that spell of fixture after fixture, win after win, he's been able to do that definitely for the fans. The players are yet to be seen. And the biggest thing with players is to be able to unite players. You need wins and you need to win silverware. Man United haven't seen to be able to do that for quite a while now. I know under Jose Mourinho, there were the FA Cups and... you know, you would say that maybe that is something that could save your job. Louis van Gaal would disagree. But I would say, with what you're mentioning as they could go out of Europe, I think there's not many neutrals on the planet that would say that Man United have a sniff of going to the Parc des Princes and being able to put on a performance that would save their European status in the Champions League this season. If they were able to qualify for top four, then there is an argument for that. But this is the thing. The players that they've got at Manchester United, they aren't good enough. I've seen for a long, long time that there have been scores of players that have been signed under reputation, but that have not fit the mould. Romelu Lukaku was signed because he was one of the top goal scorers in the Premier League. That hasn't worked out. Anthony Martial was signed for a good reason from Monaco. He hasn't been playing as much as he should. You see that Marcus Rashford is always being rested, and you see that when he does play, he is a fantastic player that is on the ball and potentially one of the best forwards in England, in the England team. I just can't see, if he was to get knocked out of all those tournaments and not qualify for top four, it would be difficult, but there's not many people who would say yeah, he deserves to lose his job, because the job that was being done by Mourinho was so poor that there was so many reasons that Mourinho could be sacked. There's not many reasons that Ollie would lose his job at the end of the season, if I'm honest.
I think there's the two sides to it, because it's crazy how prior to that PSG game, everybody was saying Solskjaer deserves to get this job permanently. Yeah. The conversation wasn't being had about him losing his job at the end of the season, but as soon as he gets taken apart, really, by a top team, the conversation comes to light. So I think there's two sides to it. The first is, if you look at that PSG game, that's the first proper test you would say United have had. They went away to Spurs and De Gea saved them there. They got a fantastic away victory, but that was the first proper test that they had, and they were outclassed in that regard, and they're out of the Champions League, basically. Let's say it as it is. The flip side to that is Solskjaer's come into a situation at, you know, disjointed, fragmented dressing room where the players aren't playing for Mourinho. The style of football is terrible, and he has galvanised the group, and he hasn't been able to bring in his own players, get rid of the dead wood, shall we say, at United. And the brief period that he's had in charge, they've won more games than they've lost. They've got an incredible run of form, and they're back in contention for the top four. So you have this debate now as to whether you gamble again, you give Solskjaer money in the summer, and you let him stay on. But he's shown in that game against PSG that still there's a little bit of tactical naivety there, and you know it's going to take a big job to change that dressing room around, the culture of that dressing room and the players that are in it, and whether he's the experience and the quality manager to do that. But he has proven during his time at United thus far that he understands the culture of the club, he's got the players playing in the right way and in a winning way, and he's got them competing again for that top four position, which if you'd said that at Christmas, you'd say it was dead and buried. So I think it's a real debate to be had. For me, I would personally give Solskjaer the job in the summer, because I think he's done more good than he's done bad. I think the only other alternative for me would be Pochettino, but again, they tried going for a winner in Mourinho, it didn't work. Pochettino hasn't won anything, so you know, do you drop down to that level, shall I say? But I think Solskjaer deserves the job regardless of what happens between now and the end of the season.
I think Solskjaer does deserve the job, but I still have this kind of feeling that he will be judged significantly on what happens in the second leg of the PSG game. And obviously, no one's really saying United will be able to turn it around. It's one of the most difficult places to go to in Europe. So, and another big part of me feels that Solskjaer is basically just a motivator. I know it's a harsh way to put it, but I don't see him as a particularly intelligent tactical manager, which is why I think if Pochettino declares sort of an over interest in the United job, he would still be seen as the more attractive option than Solskjaer, or even someone like an Allegri, who doesn't play that sort of all-out attacking football but is still very tactically clever, very tactically flexible. So as well as Solskjaer has done, I kind of see it as a kind of history repeating itself, with obviously Di Matteo coming into Chelsea being incredibly successful because he was a good motivator but not working out in the long term. You can make the same argument with Tim Sherwood at Spurs working out initially, at Aston Villa working out initially, but then kind of proving pretty detrimental to the club. But with me, I think I do admire Solskjaer, even as a Liverpool fan. I think he's really committed to the club, and I admire that admiration and his passion, but I don't think he's the right long-term option for Manchester United.
Yeah, I'll just quickly say I think I've already actually changed my mind listening to the guy. I think if Chelsea actually go out and play without any fear and just think, look, everyone's expecting United actually really to win this, no one's really expecting much on us, as long as we don't really humiliate themselves like they did against City, they could very well walk away with a win here. And I think it might possibly be a case that that's exactly what happened with PSG. Yes, you know, PSG were pound for pound probably a more superior team when we look at it on paper, but they had some big injury losses actually in that squad, and everyone was saying before the match that if you're going to take PSG, now might be the time you want to take them on. And then amazingly, amazing to United fans, they were then suddenly, you know, this was a team that didn't fear them, that went out thinking, no, we're better than you, we know we are, and we're not going to let you just run the game. And I think if Chelsea do that, although I don't really think Sarri's system exactly works, I really hope I'm not going to be wrong with this, that I think Liverpool could turn United over, because Liverpool will not sit off. They will not sit off United. They will not give United respect. I mean, some of the games we've watched them play, Cardiff, you're always going to beat Cardiff, you know, that was his first game. Then the Bournemouth match, for example, looking at that, Bournemouth showed them respect at home. It was very much a case of, God, we know this team is dangerous, we need to be very careful. I think if And that's exactly what Tuchel did. Tuchel went, well, I'm just not going to let you have the chance. I'm going to go at you with everything I've got. He changed up his formation. He showed his tactical analysis, and Solskjaer had no way of responding to it. So if Sarri is able to have thought something through where he can counter him, and this is a bit iffy with Sarri because we don't really know what he ever does, there could be an upset on the cards, which is a weird thing saying it's an upset when we're saying Chelsea could beat Man United, when probably, you know, this time last season we'd have said that Chelsea would have been the favourites.
Yeah, I think it'll be a great game. I think this brings on to probably a broader topic when we're talking about Ole, in terms of, you've heard this week, in terms of the debate, or maybe Frank Lampard going to Chelsea as a sort of interim manager. I've heard that. Dec's looking very surprised. I have heard these rumours if Sarri gets sacked for a caretaker. And Martin O'Neill, we're seeing it at Forest at the moment. And I don't agree with legends being managers. I think they get too much leeway. I think they get too much. I think the results don't seem to matter as much when it's legend. They get way too much time. I think that might be what happens with Ole. We haven't seen his transfer policies or anything like that. We've seen that he's a reactive rather than proactive manager. And that's not what you want in a Man United manager. They need someone who's going to bring them progress now, and I think Pochettino is going to do that a lot more than Ole. What do you think about the legends being manager debate?
I think, listen, the reason why I pulled that face was it reminded me of when Newcastle were really struggling for managers, and in the odds, Colaccini was one of the players who was put in the odds list, and I was thinking, oh my God, that's the list that you're going down. In terms of, so the question you asked, whether legends should be managers, listen, I don't think it's right for legends to go straight into managing your own football club, because, listen, if you were that fragmented that you needed to bring in a legend of all people to be able to reunite the dressing room, then I do think that points towards naivety rather than experience. If you have a right board of directors and a right set of people who are playing with a full deck, who actually understand football, you're going to go for people who understand the game a lot longer than somebody who's just played the game and then gone straight into management. People will say, and it's been widely catalogued, the fact that playing the game and managing the game are two completely different things with two completely different sets of skills. Gerrard had to go out of England to be able to have a chance to be able to manage Liverpool in the future. Frank Lampard had to drop down a division. I understand where some players can be able to go into coaching into different leagues and then go back to the league that they're most when they played in that they played in their career. But I know that, I mean, Alan Shearer will probably vouch for me on this one. Going from playing at one football club and then deciding to manage your football club, it's not the way to go in terms. It's a bad managerial decision, a bad career decision, in my opinion.
I'd say the ultimate comeback, just from being a devil's advocate, would be Zinedine Zidane. He came through, and then he wins three European Cups in a row. You could just argue that's a fluke, because it doesn't happen as much.
I will caveat that with, if you have an army of money, then you will be able to have victories, and Cristiano Ronaldo, then fair enough. I won't say that Zinedine Zidane had... There was nothing that was behind winning the Champions League three times. That's a fantastic achievement. But what I will say is, it definitely does help if you do have endless amounts of resources to be able to get you to the top.
The only thing I'd argue with that is that I think he pretty much in the last final had exactly the same team as he did in the first final. Yeah. He didn't make that many signings. I think the caveat of Ronaldo is an obvious one, but I don't know. Does a Ronaldo a Champions League make? I don't know.
I think actually the... Kind of linking back to when you're talking about Solskjaer before, we were saying about him being a man manager. I think that's sort of what Zidane was known for, be brilliant at. He was the exact person to just basically put an arm around Ronaldo, saying, look, I know you want to play every season, I know you want to break all the goal scoring charts, but we've got Getafe next in the league, and we're then playing Dortmund the following in the Champions League. I'm going to rest you for the Getafe game. I trust some of the younger lads to do it for me. I'm not being harsh on you, I'm just saying you're better utilised in these matches. Zidane was a great man manager, and tactically he had really only one of two tricks which he could ever do. It was the 4-3-3, where he used his personal experience with, obviously, Claude Makélélé, where he put the emphasis on Casemiro to be that assurance. And Dec's right in the sense of, they had infinite amounts of money. They also didn't have to worry about losing their great talent. But they also had probably the best squad in the world anyway throughout that period for most of it. And Zidane's other trick, which he would just do, is switch to a 4-3-1-2, where he'd just drop Isco in that hole in between. And that's what he did against, tries to do against Liverpool in that in the start of the Champions League, and it didn't actually work. So he had to switch back to his other plan. Just on the topic of legends and managers, counter the Zidane one, I would then throw in Thierry Henry. I think we'll leave that one there as it is. But my general view is, no, I hate former players when they then go into management, because there's a mixture of both. Some you have great ones, like obviously Guardiola, Cruyff, and Lampard, I think, actually could, because he's a very intelligent bloke. But these are, you know, they're a bit of rarities when you look at it. And then you've got, on the other hand, every other footballer under the sun then thinks he has the entitlement to then become a manager. And this is my own personal hatred with it, because I hate it when this happens. And you have, I seem to be in a bit of a ranting mood today, somewhat half-witted footballers that don't really understand a lot about how the game has changed, thinking they know what they're doing, and ending up like
Tim
Alan
Sherwood.
Pardew. Well, I was going to say like Alan Pardew, you know, not really that competent when you look at the fundamentals of it. And I think it's better when you look at like the Bundesliga, where you have these young managers that actually get the training and the proper raising up through it, that then show they are better at it. So I do agree that I think sometimes legendary managers are given far too much time when, say, if Julian Nagelsmann, for example, had been in like Henri's job when he was just breaking through as a young coach, they'd have probably given him like 5 games and gone, no, you're useless, get out.
Yeah, part of me thinks, like, would Frank Lampard going to Chelsea for, 3-4 months actually be much better for him than, like, staying at Derby and potentially getting promoted and potentially being that manager who could keep them in the Premier League? Because he's done an excellent job so far, I think. I think they're in fifth, don't quote me on that, but, like, they're definitely in the promotion run. He's got Harry Wilson there, he's got Mason Mount there, I'm not saying Derby's a better team than Chelsea, obviously. I just think that at the moment he should just stay where he is, because if he didn't last a full season at Derby and just went straight to Chelsea and then left in the summer, that wouldn't aid his managerial development at all, to be honest. And like coming in... coming into Chelsea with a system that's kind of confused between defensive and attacking football is not an easy job for anyone, particularly someone who's only been managing essentially for 6 or 7 months.
So I think you've touched on that, Alex. I think on aggregate amount of achievement, going into Chelsea and being able to win 3 or 4 games the same way that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has been able to do against the likes of Bournemouth and Cardiff and Newcastle, that's not something that points towards you being a top-tier manager. What it does is being able to achieve something and being able to turn around fortunes. Derby has had so many near misses with the fact that they've got to playoffs and not being able to just get there, getting to a playoff final and losing quite dramatically. I just feel that Frank Lampard should be happy where he is, and it would take an enormous amount of arrogance and confidence that I don't believe Frank Lampard has to be able to say, you know what, I'm going to jack this in and I'm going to go all the way to Chelsea. Because what is the point? And that's why where these rumours came from is, I think, a very dark place in some media room where they're thinking, who can we target and where on earth are we going to be able to find a story? Oh, we'll target Frank Lampard and say, well, if he doesn't take the job, then that's just a move of cowardice. No, it's not. It's fine for managers to be able to get their experience somewhere and being able to take them to the Premier League. Think of how fantastic it would be if Frank Lampard was able to get Derby to the Premier League with what he had. And thinking the fact that when he got there, there was a lot of pessimism surrounding Derby. There was a lot of fans who were thinking, oh, you know, it might be cool to have him, Frank Lampard, but what's he going to do? He might get you to the Premier League. And fair enough, that might what might end up happening is you might get relegated. But who would have thought, before Frank Lampard, that they would be able to make that extra step and go there? I'll go over to Steven Gerrard with what happened with Rangers. Rangers were in no way when he went in at all in the title race. Not whatsoever. There was a lot of pessimism surrounding Rangers. And this is why I don't mind legends going into management. But if you're going to go into management, don't do it at your boyhood club straight away. It just seems like the wrong thing to do, in my opinion.
The only thing I'd argue with that is that sometimes when managers go too low, so like Paul Scholes at Oldham, you'd say, or Sol Campbell at Macclesfield, there's almost a glass ceiling for them already in terms of they're not going to walk straight from a League Two job to a Premier League job. They're going to have to go probably League Two, then League One, then Championship, and then maybe Premier League, because there's so many good managers. I'd probably say someone like the Cowley brothers for Lincoln, who've done such incredible jobs, and like Nathan Jones for Luton, who just got the Stoke job. It's a better job, But if he has to do a miracle with Stoke in order to then get to the Premier League, when maybe he might be a better manager than Alan Pardew, etc. So can you really blame these people who want to step into the Premier League already? So at least they've got the possibility of going to a higher club at some point.
Possibly, yeah. I think part of that boils down as well to the factor of sometimes the arrogance that quite a few managers sometimes will have with regarding it. As a MacTown fan, I can say that Campbell has made it abundantly clear that this is just a stopgap for him. He's clearly got his eyes higher up. He's just trying to basically earn his coaching badges. And to be fair, we've been playing okay under him, but there's also all the financial issues that are going on at Macclesfield, which I'll save for another time because he's basically bankrupting the club with his wage. But with someone like Scholes, for example, the case, obviously, the most high profile one of recently of him going to Oldham, that's kind of a mixture because he said it was his boyhood club really that he grew up with, so I think he's probably quite content to be at Oldham. And also, Scholes has never been a flashy, he was flashy when he was on the pitch in terms of his style of play, but outside of it, he's always been quite an insular guy. And I think he's probably someone which would be probably just quite content maybe for just sitting, having the managerial job. You know, if he loses his job, he'll probably take a bit of time out, go back into punditry. I think it depends on the personality of the person that's taking charge of it. Whilst, on the one hand, you've got the arrogant so-and-sos of Campbell that are purely clearly have their eyes on one day lifting the Premier League as Arsenal manager or something, or Tottenham, we never know with Campbell. And then on the others, you've got, the more kind of humble guys that are just thinking they're happy to be in the job.
I mean, interestingly, with Scholes going to Oldham, that just reminded me, Oldham was the place where Lee Johnson, the guy who's currently at Bristol City, started. And he's a manager I've kind of tracked for the last sort of few years. I think he's still exceptionally young. Bristol City play a very sort of good brand of football. And Scholes isn't going to completely follow that kind of career map. But Lee, just mentioning Lee Johnson, I think he is one of those managers who definitely deserves a chance in the Premier League, but is being overlooked because he didn't have a very prominent playing background. He came in as a manager very young, and because he hasn't had that opportunity in the Premier League yet, people are just going to the sort of more well-known talents. But I think he's someone who could really be quite interesting in the Premier League.
We were talking about maybe towards the top of the table before the song break, but now we'll be going towards the bottom. And after the action-packed Cardiff-Southampton game, where Southampton thought they'd snatched an equaliser at the death, but Cardiff rallied back and got a goal to make it 2-1. And with the controversial Burnley versus Brighton game, where Burnley eked out a victory, but it was filled with lots of controversy, including a possible Brighton penalty. And with that, it puts the table into a very interesting position, with any of five teams possibly going down. And I just want to ask the panel who they think is going to go down. And I'm going to go to the man who will know the bottom of the table the best, the Everton fan, James Aldridge.
Very good. Very good. That's the first one. Yeah, you've got it in early.
Get them all in.
Well, I think, considering we were able to beat them the other week, I think Huddersfield are already dead and buried. The new manager,
glowing endorsement there.
Yeah, he hasn't seemed to have that great an effect upon the Huddersfield team. But I think that's to do with the limitations that they've got. We were just saying off air, other than Aaron Moy and Philip Billing, is there any real quality within that Huddersfield team? They work really hard, but there's nothing really up the final third of the pitch anyway. Mounier and Depoitre, they're about as fast as me, to be honest. So I think they're probably gone. Southampton, forgive me, Joe, the order of the table. So Huddersfield are bottom.
It's Huddersfield on 11 points, yep. Fulham on 17, Southampton in 18th position on 24, Cardiff in 17th on 25, Newcastle in 16th on 25, Burnley in 15th with 27, and Palace in 13th for 27, and Brighton 14th to 27. So there's six-ish teams there that are within 3 points of going down.
Well, I would say Huddersfield and Fulham are more or less gone. I don't think Ranieri's had the effect that Fulham were hoping for when he went in there. Despite, I do think they've got some really, really good players in the final third. Fulham, actually, Sherlin, Mitrovic, Sessegnon as well. It just hasn't worked out for them because they can't keep clean sheets. Southampton's an interesting one because obviously they beat us the other week, and Hasenhüttl.
You'll get there eventually.
Yeah, we'll get there eventually. Yeah, he seemed to galvanise them initially, and tactically they seem to be a lot more solid and more difficult to beat. But the wheels have fallen off a little bit. And Cardiff, they beat Leicester away the other week in the last minute, a last minute win away at Southampton. They have this knack of nicking points and results where you wouldn't expect it. Plus, under Warnock, you've got that solid back four, but the counter to that is Warnock is, you know, his record in the Premier League is abysmal. He hasn't kept a single team up whilst he's been manager. So I think Huddersfield and Fulham are gone. And despite what I just said about Cardiff picking up results here and then, I think Warnock's reputation and record in the Premier League speaks for itself. And I think they don't have the quality. It's a Championship team punching above their weight, really. And I think that they're going to go down as well.
Alex, are Brighton in the mess? Because they're on 27 points. They've lost four out of the last five and got a draw in the other game. They're only 3 points from Southampton in 18th. Are they in? Because we thought at the beginning of the season, they'll probably be fine. They beat teams like Manchester United, who didn't at the beginning of the season, but are they in it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame because, like, for the first two or three months of the season, they look very comfortable. They look like they might sort of challenge for the top 10 or just at least be in that kind of comfortable mid-table zone. But they've really dropped off in the last five games. Personally, I think they will get out of it. I think the likes of Gross and Murray and Lacadia are actually, like, I know Glenn Murray, he's an enigma. You wouldn't think he'd be an effective striker, but he's still, you know, at the age of 35, 34, I don't know, like mid-30s, he's still kind of banging in the goals. And the fact that they have Lacadia and he's not even starting is really interesting because he's quite a dynamic player. And I do think they have decent players at the back as well, like Lewis Dunk and Shane Duffy are a great combination. And obviously Matt Ryan in goal, the Australian international, is someone else who is certainly Premier League quality. Yeah, I mean, it is a challenge for Chris Hughton, but I think Brighton will stay up. I don't know if they'll have the most comfortable next couple of months, but I think there is certainly enough, particularly when you compare them to teams like Cardiff and Burnley. On paper, the actual talent that Brighton have is sort of far superior, to be honest.
I mean, they've got a relatively okay run in, to be honest, when you look at it. I mean, aside from the problem is they've got a horrible real last two games. Well, I say horrible. They've got a terrible last game and an iffy penultimate game. They've got Man City as their final game, and then before then they've got that's at home. They're actually interesting. That was the first game of last season, actually, if I remember correctly. It was Brighton versus Man City at home. Don't ask me how I remember that. Arsenal, then before then they've got Charles the Emirates. So like they've got two tough games at the end, and they've got Spurs as well. They have to go to Wembley on match week 33. I mean, I'm assuming it won't be the Spurs stadium. It'll still probably be in Wembley. But aside from that, they've got a run of relatively winnable games for them. But the key for them is going to be that they're actually against sort of teams that are nearabouts. And they've got Newcastle on match week 36. They've got Cardiff on match week 31. Huddersfield on match week 29. So they've got important matches coming up for them. But just to agree with Alex, I think they should stay up. I mean, they've got some really, they have got some really good players that can form like a solid core of the squad. And not many people criticise Chris Hughton. I mean, their recruitment has been pretty sound. It's been well praised. There's been a bit of issue with some wondering, actually, is this the board signing players because they have a certain policy and they're not players that Hughton wants, and he's sort of been forced to put them in. I'm not even going to dare to pronounce the name of the Iranian winger they have.
Yukanovash.
Him. There we go.
I know that.
I mean, that's brilliant. Someone does. He very much hasn't played quite a bit. I think he's one of their more expensive signs this window, if not their most, which possibly hints that the board wants him and not Hughton. But they've got a good squad. They've got a good court. And I'm actually very glad that, for once on this show, the shout-out to Gross was not by me.
What about Palace? I'm reading here, they've only scored 27 goals this season, which is worse than Burnley, Brighton and Southampton. And they've conceded 34, and they are very much in this with only one win in the last five. And they're only 3 points off Southampton in 18th. Are they in contention?
I don't think so. I think Palace have the Zaha factor that you would say with him in your side, it just doesn't seem likely that you're going to go all the way to the end of the season and drop down to the Championship. I just think Palace have just about enough, which makes me then think next season, if they were to get gutted and a lot of other teams would poach some of their higher profile players, I do think that there are some teams that are interested right now in Andros Townsend. Apparently he's got some quality that I'm definitely not seeing. I do feel that Palace should be able to survive. It's everyone below them are in their own mini league, I believe. I think with Brighton, Burnley, Newcastle, I mean, we mentioned Cardiff before. I just feel that Cardiff, although they are lacking severely in quality, I do feel as if the unity and the quality in terms of how they're able to perform in some tough fixtures when they're up against it should be able to keep them up.
That's where I sort of feel like the likes of Southampton, Newcastle, I feel like those two teams, despite the fact that Hasenhüttl, when he came in, actually had quite a good start, I just don't know how far the Southampton team can go. You know, I think that their stay in the Premier League, it might be coming to its end really with this season. I just don't think they have enough to stay up.
So you're backing Southampton to go down?
Yeah.
Okay. Does anyone think Burnley are in contention to go down? I'm just going to say every team, Burnley or Newcastle.
I'd like them to
go down. I mean, yeah. I think everyone wants them to go down. They're boring. Nobody really likes them. Sean Dyche's voice was interesting at first, but no longer is anymore.
They're coming out of it though. They've had an upturn in results, and with Dyche, he is a good motivator. Like slightly, relatively in comparison to the start of the season. But yeah, I think they will come out of it. It's a shame. Like the only player I really sort of like watching is Goodmanson. Other than that, it's very tedious, but I think Burnley will get out of it again.
I think they won't. I think they're going to go down. I've just looked at the fixtures again. Arsenal last day, then Everton. Well, that's 3 points there. Man City, though, the week before. Chelsea the week before that. Cardiff, massive game that prospect between how that could go. Bournemouth, Wolves, Leicester, the Reds, Palace, Newcastle and Spurs. They are not... They have not got a nice run in, actually, to be honest. I could see them going down because I've not been impressed at all with Burnley this season. However, Sean Dyche has done the masterstroke of suddenly deciding, actually, and remembering that Joe Hart is way past us and that actually he does have two good keepers on his bench. I could see them being the last day one that just drops in, possibly literally like going down to the wire. It could very well go down to it being... I think it'll be Southampton and Burnley fighting for that last spot, and I'm actually quite annoyed at that because I think if Southampton keep Hasenhüttl, regardless whether if they drop down or stay up, they could build a good team, actually, with him in charge, because he is a very good manager, and I do like him a lot.
Okay, I think what we've gathered here is we have absolutely no idea who is going to go down, but we all want Burnley to go, because we hate them. But on Huddersfield, we touched on them a little bit earlier. They're dead and buried. And I've been looking at their fixtures this week, and me and Jez have been talking about the Derby record, which is 11 points, which is what they're on now. And I was thinking, are they actually going to pick up another point this season? And the winnable games are Newcastle away, Brighton away, maybe Bournemouth at home. Then I'm looking down here, maybe Watford at home, and then Southampton away on the last game of the season. Unless there's a major upset in any of the other games, are they going to get another point?
I won't say the fact that their third from last game is against Liverpool at Anfield. I mean, I hope that we aren't sort of worried in that, because my own mindset was that, well, hopefully by that point, Wagner will just let Klopp have the 3 points to win the league. But I don't know. They could slip. There could be some slips in there. We don't know. They haven't got to play Chelsea or Man City, so they've dodged that bullet. But I don't know. I don't really think there's going to... I agree with you, Joe, actually. I can't really see that many, apart from maybe on the last day against Southampton, any that they could...
But Southampton might be fighting for their lives that day.
Yeah,
that's,
they might
that's
be motivated.
The only problem. I think Watford
it could be cruising. Watford could be on the beach by that point. It's the fourth from last game of the season. Watford do tend to switch off, or depending if Watford do a good cup run in the FA Cup, because they are the only team, well, they are one of the few teams we know at the moment that is through, they could be focusing on maybe a cup run. So maybe that one, but there isn't much in there for Huddersfield.
Maybe Bournemouth, just sort of looking, just because it's at home. But I think Bournemouth are in a pretty comfortable position. But like, I don't think Eddie Howe's the kind of manager who'll let them sort of slack off for the next 2 months. So maybe I can't see them beating Bournemouth with sort of Bournemouth's attack, but maybe a point.
Bournemouth don't give up. That's the thing.
Yeah.
Even when they were 4-0 down against Liverpool on both occasions this season, they just still keep trying. Yeah. I think it's why everyone loves them. They just have an attitude.
Their front four is ridiculous as well. I was reading an article about sort of Brooks, Fraser, King and Wilson, their numbers collectively. It's unbelievable. Particularly David Brooks, I think he's a really exciting player.
It's probably been the most surprising signing of the season, I'd say.
Yeah, I've had 50 million to Man United for David Brooks. God. Not sure about that one.
Standard.
Okay, I think we'll move away from the relegation places now, because we don't know anything. And we'll move to something that we might know. Now, I was talking about this with James Aldred briefly before the show, and I'm going to throw it to him first. I've been thinking about this for so long. What is the point in supporting a club from 7th to 12th? I'm just going to... Because Chelsea are in 6th with 50 points. Wolves are in 7th with 39. So there's absolutely no way, unless Chelsea have a collapse, that they're going to reach
them.
Leicester are in 12th on 32 points, and Palace are in 13th to 27. They could catch them, but okay, we can put in Palace if you want. And since the new UEFA, well, I think they've always been the rule where seventh only gets Europa League spot if neither the winner of the FA Cup or the League Cup are champion. If they're both Champions League clubs, so what do you look at when you go into the season? What are your hopes and dreams on the first day of the season? I really want to know what you want from a season. What is the point?
Should be good.
Well. Not only do I take great offence at this question, to be fair, I had this conversation with my housemate when I saw this was on the agenda, and we were actually chatting for like 15, 20 minutes because there are multiple layers to this question. Because the argument I suppose that you're implying is that what's the point in. And it's actually a conversation that quite a lot of Evertonians have had recently. What's the point in winning against teams below you at home, struggling to get away from home, and then dropping points against the top teams, getting knocked out of the cup competitions early on, and when it comes to qualification for Europe, not taking it particularly seriously because the Europa League, the narrative has seemed to change over the years. If you'd asked this question like 10 years ago, as an Evertonian, what's the point of supporting Everton? I would say, well, we've just come on the back of a really good run in the Europa League where we've got to the last 16. We've just reached an FA Cup final and lost, right?
But a good run, is it?
Well,
Fulham got to the semi-finals, didn't they?
They got to the final, actually.
The final, yeah, there we go.
Lost to Leicester.
And Everton.
Still lost.
Happy with last
still
16.
Lost.
Wow. Yeah. That just tells you everything, doesn't it?
Last team. Don't listen to him, James.
I'm just being
continue.
Bullied.
Sorry, I'm continue. Just,
well, so... And then the flip side to that, if you're not going to progress in the Cups, if you're not going to progress in Europe, then what's the point? The flip side to that is the Leicester City argument, how they managed to win the league and, you know, that's what everyone should aspire to be. But if you look at what's happened to the top four since Leicester have won the league, they've all strengthened. I mean, Liverpool have discovered that they've got money and, you know, on their way to buying. Yeah, very true. And, you know, so you can't compete in that regard. So I understand that point, but... Football's more than just winning things, or in your case, getting to finals and losing.
That's very wholesome. Well, at least we got there, mate.
Yeah, very true.
I think what it does boil down to is I think it's quite a pessimistic viewpoint to just say you just need to be able to turn up and always see your team win. It's quite an arrogant sort of feel to always expect your teams every single week to be able to win football matches. Not because of the fact that part of the game is the fact that you lose games. It's the same way that winning games is part and parcel of it. Depending on what team you support, depends on how many times you're going to win. And it also depends on how much you're going to cherish each single win. Now, I don't know what it's like to support Everton. But what I can understand is most Everton fans enjoy supporting Everton when they win. There are some Everton fans that I don't believe actually at all enjoy it when they win because they just never seem to be happy. James, however, enjoys when Everton win, and that's something that I enjoy seeing football fans enjoying seeing their team win. Where am I going with this point? What I want to get to the crux of it is if you're a fan in mid-table and you're saying, we're not progressing, we need to sack the manager, we need to improve the side. Get a life. You need to understand that you can't just want to... Having a stability rather than just thinking that we need to axe certain players and be able to bring in X, Y, and Z is the way forward. I think a very archaic, very Machiavellian way of managing a football side. And let's be honest, fans don't know everything. And in my personal opinion, I don't think, and you know, the case in point being West Brom. West Brom at one point were very, very happy being mid-table, not really challenging much in the higher tiers, but it started creeping down the table. Stoke being another one, Stoke actually being the archetype of this. What they would do is they would just get into mid-table every season, and then suddenly when they sack Tony Pulis, they end up trying to incorporate a fancy style of play to be able to push up the league. That didn't work out, and now they're in the Championship, and we're saying it's almost a miracle if they're able to get into the Premier League.
you need to support your football team based on your means. And I think certain fans do accept that, especially the mid-table supporters. And that's why I don't really have much to... I don't have much to argue against any person who supports a mid-table club.
I think some of the mid-table clubs are actually on the rise. If you look at how much money has been sort of ploughed into West Ham, into Wolves, even into Everton as well, like, and sort of top quality players are going to these clubs, so there must be a reason for them to go. Like Felipe Anderson going to West Ham for like 40 million, that was a huge signing. You know, 5 years ago, most West Ham fans would be sort of, they were happy they had sort of Joey O'Brien and George McCartney and James Tompkins. And now they've got, you know, Arnautovic, they've got Anderson, they've got Lanzini. I know he's injured, but the fact is, you know, the quality is improving. And with Everton, you know, they got Sigurdsson. Sigurdsson could have gone to a top six team, but he chose Everton. So, you know, there must be something there. He was a great player at Swansea, and he... is okay at Everton.
It's like one of the most backhanded compliments. He could have went to a top six.
Yeah, he could have gone to a big... No, not like that, but like... he did. That was genuinely meant to be a compliment. Yeah, like, he did go... He chose Everton for some reason. That is a good thing. You know, the mid-table clubs are on the rise, and Wolves is an example. I reckon Wolves will break into the top six, into the top four in the next couple of years because the money's there, because, you know, the ambition's there. And I think Everton, West Ham are kind of following suit in a way.
Yeah, I'll leave the Everton bashing, because I think we've sort of done that enough.
Unintended.
Yeah, unintended Everton bashing. I think James needs a bit of time to recover. But it's one thing which I like about this season in the Premier League is there are none of those teams which, like your West Broms or your Stokes, which just sit there and they rot, because they've always been awful to watch. When we're looking at mid-table, you know, we've got down, you know, Wolves right the way down to, let's say, Palace then, for argument's sake. You know, you're looking at those teams. The way that I think these sort of mid-table clubs are kind of correctly starting to approach season is they're getting managers in not for a one season. You know, the idea of getting Marco Silva was that he would be a long-term one. The idea, obviously, of Pellegrini was he was going to reinvent them and rebuild them around it. Nuno Espirito Santo has been there for a year. He started to build a bit of an idea of how a Portugal club FC are going to play in the Premier League. And then you've got Eddie Howe's Bournemouth. Corpuel's Leicester is a bit of a tricky one. I'll come to that in a minute. But all of these clubs are sort of... the mantra which they're going with is they're sort of trying to build up and get themselves ready for... You might have maybe one or two seasons where you're just stuck in that kind of mid-table gap, but you could then have, you know, one season or maybe two seasons where you get right the way up and you are, you know, comfortably in the Europa League places, and you might even just be knocking on the door that little bit of a Champions League place, or you win an FA Cup, you have a really good run in Europa League, you know, you get to a semi-final and you lose to Atletico Madrid, for example, something like that, or a team that's dropped out of the UCL that you're having to play that is by far someone that, you know, with respect to these teams, you know, out of your league, but you give it a good try. And as long as I think teams are playing well, that's kind of the idea. Like, Bournemouth is the one, for example. I'm going to contrast Bournemouth and Leicester here. Bournemouth, the fans love the way they're playing. They're, you know, they've risen up the ranks. They've done so well. And they're just happy as to where they are because they enjoy watching their team play. They are fun to watch and play. Leicester, by contrast, rise up the league, perform the greatest miracle in the Premier League history that we've seen of that title win. Granted, it helps when the league falls completely to pieces and everything goes mad. But then they're playing turgid football and no one wants to basically watch them play. So it's sort of a case of, if you ask me as to what these teams would look for, it's, well, what do we want to turn the club into? Do we want to make them into a club that's just knocking on the door of trying to break into the top six? Or do we want to just sit and rot like a West Brom or a Stoke until eventually the amount of rot we've got in that team catches up with you and you crash out of the Premier League like, you know, Stoke, Villa. I will throw Villa in there because they certainly were in that mindset for me. Stoke, Villa and West Brom all did.
Yeah, I think that's a good argument. I think Leicester is a particularly good one in terms of they are a complete anomaly. And I think they are the hardest. I feel so sorry for Corpuel because I think he's a great manager and I think they are in a situation where they've all seen their club win the title. They've had that best season ever. They've had that best moment of their footballing lives. And then they've got to crash down to mid-table. And almost nothing is going to satisfy them. And I just want to know, like, Leicester especially, I would argue there's no real point in them existing. I mean, I think that's quite an extreme way of saying it, but they're not going to get to the heights they were before. And their supporters are just going to be unhappy when they do lose to the bad clubs. Even when they only have a little bit of respite when they beat City or something, I think a club like Burnley would probably parade that for the rest of the season.
I think this
the main thing that I've been quite listening to what some of you guys were saying, and it really brought back an anecdote that I had when being from the Northwest. I know quite a few Stoke fans. A lot of them are my friends, and I would probably say that what you tend to gather from the last 10 years of being a Stoke fan is that when I've spoken to them, I've said, I hate playing Stoke. And they were saying, yeah, we love that. We love the fact that we're the, you know, the underdog of the Premier League. And I said, no, you're not the underdog. You're the garbage dog. You're the tip. You're the junkyard dog who's been scrapping in the Premier League and nobody really wants you there. And they went, yeah, we like that identity. That's our identity. We like the fact that we are difficult to play against. We like drumming down top teams and putting in massive performances. And I said, even though you're putting in bad performances in terms of bad style of play, and they're like, yeah, as long as we get good results, that's fine. That's what they identify as being a Stoke fan. A few years go by, bring in Mark Hughes, bring in Jadon Shaqiri and a load of flashy players. And I said, so Stoke City have gone fancy now? And they went, oh yeah, we like that. And I said, but a few years ago, you liked the fact that you were a junkyard dog team. And they went, yeah, but sometimes you've got to be able to get yourself out of that. And I said, don't get me wrong, this is almost like putting a pig in a dress, isn't it, really? Mm-hmm. You're changing your identity because it suits you and because of the fact that it's now more marketable to be a football team that plays different style of football. Lo and behold, Stoke get themselves relegated and now they're condemned to the Championship, some people would say, to where they belong, so that they can be able to play that style of play and identify as to what they were. Going to what you were saying about Leicester, the whole of the aura around Leicester has been sort of not corrupted, but it's been confused by what happened with the title. Winning that title meant to them that they were thinking, well, God, we're a top team now. We're like top four, top six. So when they lost Mahrez, when they spent a truckload of money on some players that didn't really work out, when the fans were sort of thinking, so we're not really a Champions League side, there's a lot of confusion around Leicester, and confusion breeds a sense of delusion around football fans to go to the game thinking, well, I don't even know what team's going to turn up, or you think one team's going to turn up and nothing turns up that you're expecting. That's why certain teams can sort of fall out of favour in the league. That's why some fans can sort of drop out of loving their team. Look at Sunderland. Sunderland at one point was seen to be, you know, an elite football team, and now I was watching them last night playing against Accrington Stanley, and they were lucky to be able to get a draw in the end.
Yeah, it's a very interesting conversation. I just want to maybe touch on maybe the crux of the argument. Are we basically saying that if you support a mid-table club, you've got to take it almost a day by day, match by match, rather than the overarching emphasis on the season? In terms of, as Liverpool fans, I think this season we've almost got too carried away to really appreciate some of the really great wins we've had. Like, you almost get a win and then you're like, yeah, this is par. This is what we need to do. We need to get these wins. We need to get another 10 in a row. We don't appreciate the wins enough. Whereas a club like Everton, I don't want to be mean, but you have 9 wins, so you appreciate those 9 wins a lot more than, for example, Liverpool's 20 wins, because you have,
I mean, Cenk Tosun's last-minute winner against Crystal Palace.
No, but what you a see moment. What I mean in terms of you're going to appreciate the wins a lot more because they don't come as often. Yeah. I see
your point there with it, because the problem is it's a bit, but I agree with that in the point that, like, for example, with Liverpool fans, you get wrapped up in the sense of, you know, for example, literally the example from last week, you know, when we beat Bournemouth 4-0, I'd completely forgotten that we'd also beaten Bournemouth 4-0 earlier in the season. Mm. And, you know, if you're a club that is a mid-table club, beating a fellow mid-table club 4-0, you probably go, that was the best performance we put in all season. Whilst with Liverpool, you kind of go, oh, yeah, that was one of our emphatic wins. Then we play, you know, for example, Huddersfield, we grind out a 1-0 and go, yeah, that's what we've got to do. We've got to just keep grinding these wins. And it loses the kind of sense of, like, what's special about a win. I agree with you with that. I think probably, you know, it sometimes depends just on the question, like, adaptability. Yeah, again, like, you know, if you asked me, for example, what's West Ham's style of play, honestly, last couple of years, I couldn't tell you. I don't think really a West Ham would know what the West Ham way is at the moment. And it's part of this idea of trying to form some sort of identity, but it's got to be fluid with how you play. And then, by contrast, you know, I'll use kind of the exact example of a good friend of ours, Ollie Roberts, in terms of, you know, he was ecstatic after the fact they beat Arsenal 1-0. He was like, that's fantastic. And, you know, Liverpool thumped them, and we were all like, well, we were happy with it because obviously it's a rival in the sort of top six. But we were like, yes, that's a big win. Now, and earlier on the show, been thinking, you know, we've got to then take on United and we've got to beat them. Whilst for these clubs, it's more a case of you treasure those moments, I think, more. And I think I do agree with your point there, Joe. I think that's exactly what these sort of clubs have. I'll hand it over to someone that knows very well about this position.
But I, there's another one.
How many are we going to get in?
It's going to be seven right now.
We're in double digits.
There does, though, and this has been, it's been a debate which West Ham fans have had, and it's a debate that a lot of our fans have had this season. There does become a point where, so for example, I'm 20, and in my lifetime, Everton have reached one cup final. They've reached, how many semi-finals have we been into? Three semi-finals, two in the FA Cup, one in the League Cup. We haven't won at Anfield in my lifetime, so we haven't beaten our great rivals, and we've qualified for the Champions League once, okay? There does become a point, and I think West Ham had this with getting rid of Bilic and not bringing in Moyes for the long term, going with Pellegrini. There does become a point where this punching above your weight, celebrating victories that against the you know, uncertain victories coming out of nowhere, beating the big teams, going on good cup runs, there does become a point where you get a bit sick of that. And I think a lot of our fans are reaching that point because, and I know I'll probably get mocked for this, like, Everton is a big club, right? Everton is like nine league titles. It's not like I know this off by heart or anything. Nine league titles, five FA Cups, you know, one of the founder members of the Football League formed just the 14 years before Liverpool Football Club was formed, you know. Big club. There does become a point where this underdog, you know, the classic David Moyes quote, when we, like, used to go away to the top four teams, he'd say, we bring a knife to a gunfight. So it's like punching above your weight. There does become a point where you get sick of that. And I think whilst, you know, there is an argument, and I'm waiting, and I'm happy to wait for Silva to try and, you know, implement his style and what have you, fans should demand the best, in my opinion, as well. There should be patience, there should be given time, but fans should demand the best. And that's why when West Ham got rid of Moyes, when we got rid of Alidos, that shouldn't be scoffed. You should praise that ambition and that attempt. Because even if it doesn't work, at least there is an attempt to try and win, to try and progress, to try and push forward. And I think that you have to respect that. And, you know.
Yeah, I think both of you kind of have raised points about style of play, Jersey did particularly. That is fine. There seems to be a kind of growing push for almost all teams in the Premier League to play a more attacking style, which I think is actually quite problematic. It's okay if it seems like Everton and West Ham, because they have that ability to kind of back it up. The problems arise when it's teams like Fulham and Huddersfield, who in the Champions League play decent, Championship play decent football attacking-wise, but in the Premier League getting completely destroyed. So my worry is there's almost not going to be any more defensive teams, and almost every team in the Premier League will play this kind of outgoing attacking style, which it might be interesting, but in the long term, is that a good idea?
I think that comes through the process of time and what football is, though. You know, trends in football come and go. And, you know, I would say that in 2008, I saw what I believe to be one of the best footballing sides that I thought I would ever see in my life in the Champions League final of Barcelona against Manchester United. I thought tiki-taka would be the future of football, and it would change football forever. It did, but I thought it would be a trend that would never die out. Trends come and go, and I feel as if to say that there'll never be defensive teams in the Premier League again, it's not naive, but it's something that is, it's just not to be perceived to be what I think football is like. When you see a trend in football, you know, that is something that you will experience probably for about 10 to 15 years. And usually when it comes to the Premier League, I like to think of each time that you see a top-tier manager being circulated, that is probably the end of one big trend. I would say, going back to what James was saying about Everton, I've got to bring up this idea of identity again, because being from Liverpool and speaking to plenty of Evertonians, there was a certain point with Everton and with my friend David that he said that the identity had almost completely gone. It wasn't the Everton that he thought he had, and that was under Roberto Martinez. And I think he said after the dismantling in the Merseyside derby, where you put out a very weakened team, but to be fair, Liverpool also put out a weakened team, and then you went to your semi-final
against Man United,
and then was not dismantled, put in an all right performance, but then lost in the last minute of the game. He just said, "I just don't know what to experience from Everton anymore." And I think that is the thing that with some fans, it's not to be scoffed at, and it's not for people to go, "Oh yeah, because you've only got fair weather supporters." It's because some teams can go through turbulent times. And to be questionable of your football team and your allegiance, it's not something to be mocked. I'll be honest, I've had it with Liverpool. I think there was a point when we had we were playing. No, it's more recent than that.
Christian Poulsen.
It was when we had. There was no Liverpoolians. There was no Englishmen in the Chelsea or Liverpool team that played at Anfield. I think it was a 1-1 draw, and I think Benteke scored, and I think Eden Hazard scored. And Hazard scored an absolute worldie, like he always does against Liverpool. And I just, in that game, just thought, I don't really know how much Liverpool is left of the Liverpool that I knew, because I always saw Liverpool as having top-tier young scousers, or scousers would be in the side, some of the best English elite, and I just didn't see it anymore. And that was my personal crisis with Liverpool in terms of identity. I want to ask you, James, have you ever had that with Everton, and has it come part and parcel with style of play? Is something being asked there?
Everton have lost their identity, I would say, prior to Roberto Martinez. I think it went, it certainly went after Martinez's first season, because when Martinez came in, he inherited the characteristics which we had under Moyes, which was a really solid defence. Everyone gets stuck in, there's commitment, there's hard work, and he sprinkled on top nice attacking football in the same way Bilic did at West Ham, to be fair, when he first went in with Allardyce. That has gone, whether it's a result of the influx of player which Martinez and Koeman tried to sign, where you kind of, in an attempt to move to a more stylish brand of football, you lost that level of commitment. I'm not sure, but Everton's identity has been lost. The what is really envious for me, not only the fantastic football that the top three or four teams are playing, but you can tell, even with Solskjaer at Manchester United, I know they had a disappointing result in week, but with Klopp over the road, with Pochettino at Spurs, with Guardiola and Solskjaer, there is that unity at the club between supporters, players, and the management team, where everybody's on the same page. There is that identity, there's that common goal and that unity, and there's a togetherness there, whereas at Everton, it's been fragmented for so long. And to be fair, they're like, the issue which Everton has, why it's a unique anomaly, sorry I'm going on about Everton,
no,
but
no, it's, awesome.
It's like...
We've erased you enough.
Yeah, you deserve this.
In Everton's history, certainly in the last 30, 40 years, there's really different identity. So my dad has seen Everton win the league twice in the 1980s, and he associates his Everton with great style of football, passionate fans and what have you, and like a really positive... The school of science is the term that comes up when you talk about Everton. That's more to do with the 1960s, with the way that they played at that time, but in the 80s it came up again. But he's also seen in the 90s, Everton stayed up on the last day of the season twice, the dogs of war kind of style of football, which was really direct, kind of getting stuck in, Duncan Ferguson, Barry Horn, these players that like wouldn't get into any other team at the time, but they fitted the bill of keeping Everton up, you know, fighters, committed, warriors, what have you. And I think that Everton's problem is we have a really split fan base in what Everton fans want. There's some that want that 80s team back, not necessarily the winning titles, but playing this fantastic brand of football. There's some that want this 90s team back, which is committed, get stuck in, don't get the results every now and then, but, you know, they show that heart and passion. And there's others who want David Moyes' Everton back, which is why his name has been thrown up into conversation recently as to, if Marco Silva was to go, would you bring David Moyes back? I personally wouldn't touch David Moyes again. But that... The thing I'm the most envious of is that the top four teams, they have that identity. Everton's identity for me went after Roberto Martinez's first season, I should say. And I do think, if you'd asked me this prior to the
Divock Origi derby game. I'll mention it before Joe does. Like, I thought Silva. Silva was bringing it back. I still think he has the potential to build this identity, which he kept banging on about in pre-season at the start of the season. But yeah, that is all I'm striving for the rest of the season. Now we're out of the cup competitions. We don't have a lot to play for other than trying to ruin your seasons and you know, try and beat some of the big teams coming to our place. But it's about building this identity, which I think has been gone for 6-7 years now.
Yeah,
it's quite scary when you think about it.
It's been a very fascinating conversation. I feel like we could go on about this for hours. There's a lot of passion in the room. I think it's been one of the best discussions I've definitely been a part of at URN.
We've completely neglected to talk about, actually, in all this chat, but Mill are still 1-0 up against Wimbledon, but that's by the by, really. And we were talking a little bit about identity before the break, and that was something that I didn't think we'd get onto, but we've been talking about this massively in the 7-ish minutes we've had in the break, and we've been talking about not just mid-table identity, but top four identity, top six identity. How it's changed over the years? And Alex was talking about it so passionately about how Liverpool's changed. Do you just want to go over that a bit?
Yeah, well, James is raising some really interesting points about Everton's identity. I was thinking, you know, in my opinion, it's a bit of a controversial, but I think we had basically a crisis of identity for about 6 years, from probably 2010 until 2016. I know it's kind of a weird set of dates, but just because in those years, like, we were making some horrible signings and we were losing some incredible players. So, example in point, 2008-09 season, we came very close to the title. We had probably the best team we'd had in a very long time when we had Alonso, Mascherano, Gerrard, Torres. Torres, yeah. 2 years on, we still had Torres, but Torres wanted to leave. But we had Poulsen, Jovanovic, Spearing, Jonjo Shelvey when he couldn't do anything. And, you know, it was... Paul Konchesky, you know, he's one of those players I've just tried to physically erase from my mind, you know. And the likes of Aurelio, Dossena, the list goes on. There were just so many players that I felt didn't epitomise the ambition that Liverpool should have had. And that was an issue of the owners, obviously, Hicks and Gillette wanting to sell, not putting enough money into the club. But I genuinely think it was a more of a long-term issue, with the exception of the 13-14 season. Obviously, we came very close to the title in that season. But the fact is, we were happy that we got Champions League football, go into the Champions League, out in the group stages. You know, that was awful. And, yeah, I basically think, I don't want to be the arrogant, yes, Klopp the saviour, but basically I think Klopp's been the person who's basically saved us ever since he got us back into the Champions League in the 16-17 season. Yeah, in the 16-17 season. But I think every team goes through a crisis, and actually we haven't, as we have four Liverpool fans here, we might as well talk about the one that sort of went on for ages with the transfer committee and everything. So, but luckily, I feel we are sort of coming out of that rut, and hopefully we'll end with the title this season, but I don't want to get onto that debate.
I think the thing with Liverpool is that I think Liverpool and the fan base, the fan base is the most critical part, because if the fan base don't come out of the crisis licking their wounds and still waging war with each other, you've done okay. Liverpool fan base right now seems fairly united. We're all back in the same team. Nobody's fragmented. Nobody's thinking that the style of play is poor. Nobody dislikes certain players. Great. Compare that to a fan base like Arsenal. And this is where this sort of idea of talking about identity was born through watching copious amounts of Arsenal fan TV and me understanding that I don't understand why Arsenal fans are so just deluded but not as a grand term, they're all deluded, but the ones that are put on Arsenal fan TV, it was something that James mentioned in the break. He said that football's more than just the result on the match day, but on Arsenal fan TV and on what the Twitterverse is, all you see whenever Arsenal lose is negativity. And I think it spawned from when the Invincibles happened, the expectation was so high, it was never going to be eclipsed. And I think because of the fact that they've never been able to come close to anything like the Invincibles ever again, I think this is going to rumble on until, I don't know, until rapture. Because I don't ever think that Arsenal fans are ever going to be happy with maybe winning the league and then going out in a Champions League. or overachieving in certain aspects, like the team that they've got now. There was talks of earlier on in the year by the man sat next to me, Jeremy, that they could get into the Champions League spaces. That would have been a huge effort. And if that would have happened, then you'd be saying, wow, Arsenal, you know, that fan base would be really happy. And I turned to the Arsenal fans that I knew and I went, yeah, Champions League, wouldn't you be happy with that? I went, no. I'm greedy. I wanna win the lot. I went, but think about it, you've got a new manager and a new team. Don't you think you can be happy with just getting into Champions League, rumbling on for a little bit? And they went, no, we need to get rid of Kroenke. We need to be able to have new owners. And I went, but let's get back to planet Earth now. It ain't going to happen. So you need to live within your own means. And this is why I think the identity in Arsenal has become so corrupted and jaded over the years, to the point where it is now that Arsenal Fan TV is almost a meme because of how ridiculous it is.
I mean, I love the fact you keep beating me over the head with this club of saying that I apparently predict them to get in Champions League. One, I don't even remember this conversation that you keep reminding me about. Yeah, well, I think it's probably when after several pints in the pub. That's probably why.
You from the stands.
Was it? Great. Damn. Thought I could get away with that. I think I probably might have said, Declan, that they might, because I was expecting at that point either Sarri not to kick on as well as he had, or for Spurs to fall away more than I think they actually did. But just going back to what we're discussing here, which is the topic of identity, I do agree in the sense that there was a long period for Liverpool where it was almost a sense of trying to refine their feet, and it was a mixture of kind of, I think, Alex said that, you know, we're not all saying that, you know, Klopp was the divine saviour that sort of came in and fixed Liverpool. It was sort of actually a lot of changes that kind of worked for Liverpool that gradually accumulated. One major one, probably the appointment of Michael Edwards as the sporting director at Liverpool, finally got someone in that was actually prepared to go, no, we're not just going to look at Southampton and say, well, who have you got that we can pinch? We instead decided we'd look at Roma and say, who have you got that we can pinch? It was more a case of Liverpool started to have a bit more ambition and were a bit more prepared to put the hand in the wallet and go, yeah, we are now prepared to pay better fees. Because my dad, bring him up again, he was saying that at one point, very much during what was, let's be fair, probably for us, like a very dark period for Liverpool, you know, it, still obviously the last thing we won is that Carling Cup trophy. Well, it's now obviously the Carabao Cup against Cardiff, which in itself was a horrible game. But the whole point is, like, since then, Liverpool's been trying to work out where the identity has been. We were teased, I think it's safe to say, with the 13-14 season as to what we thought we were getting. We don't really know what that was, just mainly because Suarez had the season of his career, really. And then afterwards, we sell Suarez, and we then did exactly what Tottenham did. We threw money left, right and centre trying to build a team with this money that didn't have a clear kind of cohesion, a clear unity. Granted, yes, three of the players we brought in that window were from Southampton, but, you know, one was an injury-ridden Adam Lallana. One was a 32-year-old Ricky Lambert, who was useless, and one was probably at the time a very hyped up defender, but then became, you know, the butt of all jokes until actually a competent defender arrived from Southampton in Lovren. So Liverpool went through this very long period of not knowing what they wanted until finally the club started to all move and started to all pull in the same direction, and since then it has been a much better progress. But I think it's sort of, if we're saying, you know, what makes the identity, it's very much a case of not just when we're looking at it, I know the other guy's going to touch on it, so I'll look at it from this angle, from one approach. You can say you need the fans, you need the, you know, everything around the club, all the literally the businesses that are around the club, all the sort of small, you know, shops, I've always said the fans, the manager and the players, but you also need the boardroom to have a clear and competent mindset as to what they do, which is what so many clubs around the world don't. Case in point at the moment, I'd say, is Chelsea. They don't have an identity because there's flip-flops every time they change a manager. They, you know, go from they go from Jose Mourinho, you know, defensive manager, to Conte's, change of formation, change of style. Suddenly everyone down to Sunday League is playing three at the back. And then you then have Sarri, who's complete opposite, very attack-focused, very possession-based. And it's this constant change and no clear mindset as to what you want to be at the end of the day. Aside from the Chelsea view, which is just, we have to win, we must win everything, it's not healthy for a club.
And that's why Chelsea have sort of lost so many talents over the years. I mean, some people just think it's kind of a fluke that they've lost Salah, they've lost De Bruyne. It's because they don't have any long-term strategy. And I feel the same will happen. I think Hudson-Odoi will eventually go to Bayern. The incentive's too strong. I think Loftus-Cheek might look abroad. I'm a huge Loftus-Cheek fan, but like, he's not going to start at Chelsea because there's this kind of arrogant perception that Kovacic is a more effective player, even though like, he's not fast at all and he doesn't do enough in midfield. But yeah, the fact is the whole loan system's still problematic because the players going out on loan aren't being properly regarded when they come back. And this is because Chelsea don't have any long-term kind of ideas, and the players who are still there, you know, Eden Hazard, or Williams, they have way too much sort of dressing room influence, in my opinion, which is arguably why Conte got sacked, when I personally don't think he should have done.
I think a lot of what the league is, though, and a lot of what the league should be proud of is based upon you sort of bread and butter, meat and potatoes, sort of mid-table teams like what we mentioned earlier. We touched a little bit upon Everton, and James, you talk about West Ham in the way that their identity was, in a sort of, in almost a meta way of how Everton have gone through their crisis, but it's much more evident with West Ham because they have moved stadiums. And this is something that I know, speaking to a lot of Everton fans in Liverpool, they're very, very hesitant about this move to Kirby, where their new ground is going to be. I just want to know how you feel about that.
Well, I think the slightly, just to pull you up on something, the new ground's going to be on the docks.
Oh, right.
Not
okay.
In Kirby. That
Sorry.
Was, no, no, it's all right. That was where Kenwright wanted to take us in 10 years ago, but that's like, that provoked a lot of debate at the time. But I think the difference is Everton are designing this stadium themselves, really. So, and there's already been meetings that have taken place. In fact, designs came out yesterday of the way they want to structure the ground, because the key architect himself has come out and said, we want to basically move Goodison and make it into a modern stadium. Basically, we want to take the features that make that you love and inject it into a modern setting. Whereas with West Ham, they saw an opportunity, they saw a stadium that was free, and they just planted a football club there, really. But it takes a lot more effort and time and kind of crafts work to make that happen, if you know what I mean. Because if you actually go to the Olympic Stadium, you're miles away from the pitch. Jez, we were talking about during the break about a West Ham fan that's on the show. Ollie was saying about how walking up to the ground, you're not surrounded by the pubs or the kind of fish and chips or the burger vans that kind of epitomise Upton Park. So the whole culture of the club changes. I think it will be less so with Everton, because I think the club are in charge of the designing of the stadium. Plus, there is already a plans in place to keep Goodison. It's going to be used as a heritage site, which Everton and the community will use. Whereas West Ham completely demolished Upton Park, and they've kind of it more or less is a brand new club, to be honest, at West Ham. Whereas I think Everton, it will just be a continuation of what we've currently got, but in a more modern setting.
So would you say something, I think you've touched on it a little bit, like money seems to have a massive impact on identity. I think that brings us towards like a clubs like Manchester City, and even a club like Wolves. I don't know, are Wolves the same club they've been? Have Manchester City clearly gone for a drastic change in the past 10 years? I don't know many Manchester City fans. I'm sure Dec probably knows a couple more than me. What do they think?
I think when I spoke to, I remember going on holiday to Sharm el Sheikh in Egypt, and the only Manchester City fan that I knew was from Kent. And I said, oh yeah, so, you know, what's it like being a Manchester City fan? And he went, oh yeah, it's great. You know, I love the players. I love David Silva. He's one of the best players I've ever seen. Sergio Aguero, brilliant. Just coincidentally, we were watching Al Jazeera, like BeIN Sports, and one of the pundits was Shay Given, and I remember me saying, oh yeah, what do you make of him? And he went, oh, just awful. Absolutely shocking. When he was at Aston Villa, just, I don't know how he's had a career. And I went, you know, he's played for you lot. Has he? Yeah, he had no idea. So I think what is interesting about Manchester City fans, the ones that I've spoken to, is the identity. It's like how we talked about the factor in the break. We talked about how there was a lot of older Manchester City fans have had their Manchester City,
And it's so changed to this sort of mass market commercialised brand that I don't think some fans, City fans, are happy with, really.
Yeah, I mean, the only time I've ever met a City fan was when I was in New York, actually, and we were watching, we were in the bar of the hotel we were staying at, and we were watching the City Liverpool game at the Etihad. And, like, they obviously like that their team is winning every week. They obviously won the league by a mile. But the little things get to them now. Like when they lost, I know it's a bit of a nightmare, but they lost against Man United, couldn't secure the league. But I don't think that's something that you should get that much annoyed about. They don't identify with the players, I think, in the way that other clubs do. You know, they had a massive hatred of someone like Raheem Sterling. Imagine if a player that good was at, I don't know, Watford or West Ham, someone like that. Note how I didn't say Everton.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, but no, that's the kind of... That shocked me so much that a player that good could be hated by fans. Like, it made no sense.
I think it's very different to actually if you're from the area. I grew up in Manchester, so I can actually say I do know quite a lot of Manchester fans. In fact, my dad's stepfather was a Manchester City fan. He grew up actually very close to the old Main Road Stadium, and it was interesting talking to him about this at times. He absolutely loves the way, obviously, that Man City play. You know, he was a massive fan of Aguero. Always, you know, every time when we would sort of catch a game with Man City on, he'd say, "Oh, brilliant, you know, absolutely, you know, by far the best I've ever seen." Because obviously players like that, they are, but he remembers kind of the club beforehand, and he's very proud of what the club is before. And it's sort of this idea of maybe fans, if they aren't, maybe don't have like that long familial connection to the club, they won't understand it. A lot of fans, quite a lot of City fans I knew went to my school, and in the period sort of just following the Sheikh Mansour takeover, when they were starting to get money, I remember one defining line, which I really, really remember, was a friend of mine when we were on a school trip, actually. I can't remember why we got talking about this. I think we were wandering around. It was meant to be this is a bit of a detail. It was meant to be like a classics trip. I think we were going around parts of Greece, looking at parts of ruins. I can't remember. But naturally, when there's seven blokes wandering around, three of them are United fans, two of them are City fans, and two of them are Liverpool fans, we naturally get on to talking about football, inevitably. And we were talking about this, and I just remember my friend Luke just said, to be honest, he hates sort of like the new fans that come in and just go, "Oh, yeah, City are fantastic at the moment." And then they go, "Oh, in the past, we were awful." It's like, if you are a Man City fan, a proper one that has grown up with the club and knows that identity from before, you would look at Stephen Ireland. Yeah, this is the one he picked out. So you look at Stephen Ireland and go, he is a club hero. Like, note, I didn't say legend. I'm not falling for Benjamin Delaney's tactic. But he would say he is a club hero because he's someone that you grew up and he was like, that is a player I just enjoy watching, and I remember watching. And he said, you know, now obviously the transition, I can't remember who it was, but then obviously David Silva, I think was sort of in the prime, he's still in his prime, but like was sort of really hitting his stride at that point. And he was like, you know, I love Silva, I think he's a great player, and he probably will surpass Ireland, but you can't forget the players which have come before, which is the issue when you've got money being thrown into it. And I was going to actually make a very, very rogue detour onto this when I was just talking about, because I remember watching a video about this, but speaking to kind of like the idea of stadium moves and how that can rip out the heart of a stadium. FC Zurich, for example, they had their stadium demolished because they wanted to build a brand new super stadium in the area. However, it would mean that they would demolish, you know, all the pubs in the area, all the, you know, the fish and chip place. Basically, what we're saying, you know, is around a football club normally. They would have to demolish it to expand outwards. So they demolished this stadium. And it's since become a park because they haven't been able to get the planning permission approved. So consequently, Zurich are now playing in their arch rival stadium. I can't remember for the life of me what it is. Their arch rival stadium in the city. So they're sharing one city, kind of, you know, like the situation we always see with, you know, with Rome clubs and the Milan clubs, which is quite often in continental Europe. But they feel, from what I was reading about this, because I saw this a while ago, I was quite curious about it. They feel that the heart of their club has been ripped out because they lost that old thing which they could always point to, like, that's our home, that's somewhere we are. Now it's sort of, yeah, this is somewhere we have to share with the people down the road that we don't like. It's a weird thing when you have, like, money can build a football club into something great and it can make it something that can stand very well, like we're seeing with Wolves, potentially, but it can also absolutely kill what is fundamentally at the heart of football, which is the love and passion for that club.
Yeah, so I actually, going back to that kind of Manchester City identity with the money point, I have a neighbour who's actually also my godfather, sort of very close family friend, who's sort of mid-70s and has been a fan of Man City for like 50, 60 years, essentially lifelong. And he kind of, I talked about the fact that he's a Man City fan, basically when they just won the title, gone over 100 points in last season. And he said, like, he almost sees Manchester City as two eras, and he's proud of both eras. He said to me, you know, no club in 2009 would turn down the Sheikh Mansour investment, so he shouldn't be cynical at Manchester City for accepting that investment. But he's also proud of the sort of pre-2009 Man City, as you said, Steven Islander, Richard Dunn. My pre-2009 Man City knowledge is very poor, so I'll just name a couple of players I know. But he said he's not cynical about the fact that they have money now. He's very proud that he can witness Pep Guardiola as his team. He would have never, you know, 20 years ago, have envisioned Manchester City as arguably the biggest club in the world, or one of the biggest clubs in the world. So there's obviously fans... people who aren't fans of Man City will be cynical of them having that wealth and that capital, but he basically defines Manchester City as two eras and doesn't think that they've lost that kind of spirit.
Yeah, I think this has been a really fascinating discussion. I think we could go about on this about identity for ages, but I'd just like to almost change gear a little bit. But we are still talking about Man City, kind of. in terms of, Alan Shearer said something really interesting last week on Match of the Day in and he suggested that Spurs have been disrespected in the title race and that we should put them in there when many, many clubs haven't. And having seen the Dortmund game on Wednesday, where they won 3-0 at home, it was a beautiful performance, one of their best I've ever seen. Are they still in it?
Do me a favour, Alan. So the reason why he said that is because, quite rightly so, Tottenham have been overlooked. They've not been disrespected, they've been overlooked. And that's probably because of the fact that when they were missing three crucial players, everyone and their grandmother were all saying, yeah, I don't really know how Tottenham are going to be able to win certain games now. Harry Kane had so many goals. The fact that he's missing, you know, that should hamper their... anything that they're going to be doing for the rest of the season. Quite rightly so. But the fact that Heung-Min Son has come back and been able to put in performances after performances, getting goals, goals is the thing that they've so dearly needed with the absence of Harry Kane. They've had goals in very important moments. The Leicester game that I watched at Wembley was one of the most bizarre football matches that I've seen this season, because the better team lost, and they lost in such a way that actually made me feel not even disappointed, but actually angry that the better team was... They conjured up so many chances, and it was just the basics that they just couldn't do. Now, with Tottenham and what's happened with them from... what will happen as the title race continues... what a lot of football is based upon. Part of it's to do with your quality, part of it's to do with your training, and part of it is to do with luck. Tottenham have had quite a lot of luck in the fact that they've been missing certain players, but still being able to pick up results. If you've got luck on your side, you can probably do some magical things in a season. And the fact that they're still in the race, they're not in the front seats, and you know that is the thing that certain Tottenham fans will have to be happy with. They're going to be outsiders from now right up until probably March, April. I know that Jez has talked about this before on Everything That Stands on the show. Sir Alex Ferguson said you don't win the Premier League at the start of the year in your January or Christmas time. It's that sort of March, April time, and if they're still in it in March and April, I think that there should be a lot of credit given to Mauricio Pochettino for what he's been able to do, and especially the players, because of the fact that when you miss somebody like Harry Kane, you're always going to be thinking, oh my God, where are the goals going to come from? Big props to Heung-Min Son is what I need to say, really.
I mean, isn't it an advantage for them that they are not in the conversation at all? There's absolutely no pressure on them to do anything. No one expects them to win the title. In fact, quite a lot of people... I think when I was on View from the Stands a couple of weeks ago, suggested they would even drop out of the top four. This kind of goes into back what you were talking about on View from the Stands earlier, but this pressure that they don't have, is that going to help them?
And the flip side to that is, you look at the amount of coverage that every single Liverpool and Manchester City game have got between now and the end of the season. You know, it's actually... It gets on my nerves almost. The amount, and not just from a bitter Evertonian's perspective, but I do kind of have a little bit of sympathy when Klopp and Guardiola are constantly asked, is this a must-win game? Is this, is it 12, 13 games left? Are these all cup finals for your team now? Whereas Tottenham, they're not having those questions asked. So I suppose going under the radar is a positive for them. They can go about their business quietly. I do think those injuries will catch up with them. I really do. I think a player of Kane's quality, the fact that they were playing on... was it Tuesday or Wednesday night they beat Dortmund?
Wednesday.
The fact it was Son, who is a fantastic player, don't get me wrong, and Moore up front. I think that can only work for a certain amount of time. I think up against strong, solid centre-backs, that may struggle. I mean, Son is a fantastic player and he can wriggle his way past anybody, but in certain contexts, you need to be able to hit up to Kane or even to... The other option they've got is Llorente, who's no good whatsoever. So I think whilst going under the radar is good because they can go about it quietly and they can sneak up on that top two. I just think those injuries have come at a terrible time for them. And I think that I think third place is about where Tottenham should be. They are the third best team in the Premier League. And they're unfortunate that they're an outstanding team, but they've got two better teams than them, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, the fact is they've also got to come to Anfield, they've got to go to the Etihad, and I can't see them.
Stamford Bridge,
they've got another North London derby, and you know
they've also got to play Everton.
Yeah,
you know,
but the fact they can't be disregarded because they've got this far, and I do have respect for Pochettino, but if they somehow beat Liverpool and Manchester City and won the title, it would be a very, very sad day because that team is fundamentally not good enough. If we lost the title to Manchester City, I'd be annoyed, but I respect it because Manchester City have an unbelievable team. Mm. If we lost the title to a midfield of Harry Winks and Moses Sissoko, I would cry uncontrollably. And
entirely out of context, though, Alex, what is difficult when you say it would be an insult is that this is where I partly have to side with Alan Shearer, because I've got to say,
God, I never thought I'd hear him say that.
I've got to say that this is definitely the best Tottenham side I've ever seen, and to lose the league to the best Tottenham side I've ever seen, it's not too insulting. I would say
that in May.
I would make me enormously disappointed, but it would never make me feel like, oh, you know, this is just one of the worst results in the Premier League ever. I would probably say I'll be more disappointed if Manchester United is still in fourth, because Pep Guardiola said that Manchester United are in the title race. If we lost the league to this Manchester United side,
I'd give up on football.
It would be an absolute disaster for the Premier League, because by far the most fragmented, most... totally disrupted Manchester United team that I've ever seen. So going back to what you were saying, I can understand, you know, Harry Winks, they're not very fantastic players in comparison to the grand scheme of the midfield of the Premier League. However, if you were to look at some of their individual parts, I would say if Heung-Min Son wasn't in PFA Team of the Year and if Harry Kane only missed out because of Mo Salah, I would say that there are only a few, maybe Vertonghen probably getting Team of the Year as well, if I was probably Silas being generous. If I was going to be generous. Mm,
all right.
No, I don't know about that.
I would say that there are only a few players in that Tottenham team that would get in the PFA Team of the Year. But I think that for the grand scheme of it, the team that has the most players in the PFA Team of the Year usually is the team that's going to win, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, you say this, and we've talked about Harry Kane's injuries and stuff, but I don't know I hold a very controversial opinion on this. As I did with England, I think we played better than Harry Kane. I thought he was terrible. I thought if we'd have played Jamie Vardy, we probably would have more handsomely beaten certain teams. And I think Spurs play better without Harry Kane, because we see this again and again. When a team has one player that is that good, everything goes through them. And unless that player is Messi or Ronaldo, they're not going to bring you silverware. If you quite a lot went through Kevin De Bruyne last year in Manchester City, but mostly you wouldn't ever describe them as one man team. And I think if Spurs can almost get rid, I don't want to say they want to get rid of Harry Kane, but I think it would it would get put a lot less pressure on them, and I think they'd play a lot better because their win ratio without Harry Kane is 60%, and 59%, and their win ratio with Harry Kane is 60%. So his contribution is extremely negligible. If you just look at the stats, I don't know what everyone else thinks.
That can be a partly attributed to maybe how Poch has set up in the absence of Kane. I mean, I going back to, God, there's been so many points bandied around here. Go back to first Declan's one about luck. I think one slice of luck that Spurs have had is the fact that by some questionable miracle, Qatar are able to knock out the reigning champions in Asia, in South Korea. I think if that meant Son came home early, and that meant that his absence wasn't as bad as was initially thought. Because I think when everyone suddenly thought they were going to collapse, Son was away at this point, and then about a game later he was back. So that has cushioned the fall somewhat because he is a very good player. If you think Vertonghen is in the team of the year, then you're either removing... I'm not going to touch on this long. I'm just saying you're either removing Andy Robertson, Virgil van Dijk, or Aymeric Laporte.
And Aymeric Laporte. I don't think...
How can you not?
What?
Anyway, if you were being generous as well...
I think he'd probably be on the bench, I'd say, maybe. Yeah. But I wouldn't put him in the starting lineup for it. Anyway, I've lost my train of thought. Great. this often happens with me. Yes, I do think Spurs are still in the title race. I said, I think, on View from the Stands a few weeks ago, I think they're still sort of the dark horse in it. They are a good team. This is probably the best Spurs team that we have been seeing. And, you know, the idea of if they're unlucky, because if Liverpool and, you know, this great Liverpool side was seeing, and if this great Man City side went in it, then we'd probably be talking about them more in glowing terms. We said the same about United last year. United accumulated 82 points, which in years gone by would have been enough to win them the league. And we would have probably praised, you know, Mourinho would have had his classic three seasons, comes in, grabs trophies in season one, wins league in season two, gets sacked in season three, blows up club in exit. usually happens, but like the general sort of consensus with what we're seeing is that there is a lot of acknowledgement that this Spurs squad is very good and is respectable, and that they are coached by a very good manager who game by game is able to set up his side to deal with the injuries that he's got, to play it how he wants them, and to, you know, let's not forget, Poch was the first manager in England that beat Pep Guardiola when he arrived. Pep arrived 2 years back and he went on an 8-game win streak, and everyone went, oh God, you know, he is as good as we all thought. Poch plays him and breaks him down, beats him 2-0, and everyone went, ooh, hang on. Everyone suddenly sat bolt upright and took notice of both this Spurs squad and Poch. And that's something which I think has been... One thing I will say, if Spurs win the league, yes, I would be absolutely gutted. I, like the guys have said, I could accept losing to City. I couldn't accept losing to Spurs. Dan Henley would never let us hear the end of it. But if that happened, huge credit has to go to those Spurs players. Huge credit has to go to Poch. Zero credit has to go to Daniel Levy.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Or Ben Davis.
Or
get out of there, hater.
Yeah, let's get all our haters out now. So... League, we're saying they're in the race, but they're not going to win, is effectively, I think, what I'm hearing from the panel today.
They deserve to be in the top three, is the general consensus. Yeah. They are the third best team.
They are definitely in the race. It's just I feel, and I don't want to say they definitively won't win, but then they have four very difficult games.
It's like
up,
an honourable third is what they will get. Like, it's a very respectfully well-earned third.
Yeah. But it's nobody wants a respectable third, though, do they?
Yeah.
I mean,
there's no trophy for that.
I do.
Oh, I mean, he did it to himself that time. You can't even say we're bullying him anymore. Fine, but in the Champions League, we're just going to presume they're going through against Dortmund because that just makes life a little bit easier. Can they do anything in this this Champions League?
They're well. Sorry.
No. sorry.
I think everyone's so harsh. I think they are a quality club and they can show that they can go against the best team.
Oh no, I just think that in terms of Champions League, I don't think that Tottenham will have enough bottle.
Get that cliche out there.
If you've got your bingo cards, your Premier League bingo cards, yeah,
it's
played
longer
that
than
one.
Expected for that one. Yeah, actually, fair.
Yeah, I just don't think that when it comes to cup competitions, you can ever rely on Tottenham Hotspur. And when you have to put them against some of Europe's elite, I just think that it's only a matter of time until they're absolutely torn apart. I mean, what happens is you get some decent results here and there, and you then start to see that you can get to the position, and Manchester United have had it. You know, if you get some decent results here and there, you can get to the point where you say, oh yeah, we could probably take on anybody. Then you stood up against Paris Saint-Germain, and then you realise, oh yeah, we're not as good as we think we are.
I think that Tottenham might be in the same position with what's happened against Dortmund. I think they'll go through in this tie and then they'll get to the position of thinking, oh yeah, we could actually probably end up doing really, really well in this competition. But I think if they were to go up against a Barcelona, a Juventus, a Paris Saint-Germain, I just don't think that they would be able to have enough clout to be able to put a decent performance, especially at these away grounds, because I don't think they could perform as well as they could at Wembley, but I don't think that some of these top teams are going to be able to, we'll just roll over and just go, oh yeah, we'll just let Tottenham play their usual game at Wembley and then go away to these away grounds and just park the bus or be able to, sorry, I said park the bus, but Tottenham don't even do that, and be able to have some sort of lead that they can take to the away ground.
I mean, I just quickly give my 2 cents on it. I think this Spurs squad has a very good chance of getting actually quite deep in. They have got a good squad and they are quite well set up for cup competitions in the way they play, and they have a very, like I've already said, you know, a very smart tactical manager that can manage games game by game. However, I think it's going to depend on how early they go up against someone that can match him pound for pound on all of that and is better, which is Juventus, because Allegri proved last year that he can beat Poch in a tactical dogfight and he has the higher calibre of players. I mean, if we're talking about, you know, if we're saying that maybe Spurs are over-reliance on Harry Kane, I literally just saw a minute ago that Juventus, 50% of all their goals and assists this season have come through Ronaldo. So there is an issue of like how then do you knock him out of it. Juventus, I think, are the team which is the ones to watch. They have probably one of the smartest tactical managers who can flexibly adapt a system with a good squad of good talent. Though, it depends, in my view, it's how early they would come up against them. Because I think, until then, I actually think Spurs could maybe knock out... I think PSG are a little bit overrated, to be blatantly honest. I think United haven't helped by that, by the fact that Tuchel did actually do his homework on Solskjaer and worked out how he could beat him. And the United boys had, you know, got scared a little bit, actually, also. But, I mean, as for Barcelona, they're an odd club to watch at times. I kind of, at times, like Ernesto Valverde, at others, I think he's a bit of a clueless buffoon, but I do at times actually think he's brilliant. You know, he has the balls to go in there and say, no, we're not playing 4-3-3, we're going to play 4-4-2 and then you get the sack for it. So I think, I don't know, I think Spurs are in contention. They have a good manager and they've got a good set of players, so I wouldn't rule them out.
Yeah, I think this has been a really good chat today, guys, but unfortunately I think we're going to pretty much going to have to leave it there. Just a quick roundup, AFC Wimbledon were beaten by Millwall 1-0. And in other scores, I think we mentioned earlier, Notts County beating Mansfield 1-0 and Brighton beating Derby 2-1 with Ashley Cole getting on the score sheet for Derby.
God!
There is a throwback. But unfortunately, that is the end of the show. Thanks to Jez, Deck, James and Alex.
This is URN Sport.